Hey, good evening, everyone. Well, we have mingled for the appropriate amount of time and a little more, which is good. So let's get this evening started. I think we're going to have a lot of fun. For those of you who I have not had the opportunity to meet yet, my name is Terry O'Reilly. I'm the president and CEO of Pittsburgh Community Broadcasting. It is terrific to see you here tonight. So welcome to this evening with NPR's Wade Goodwin. Thank you for coming out on this blustery night. I saw there was snow today. I want to acknowledge there's some members of our board. BJ, Harold, Paul, and Kathy are here. Hello, hello. Thank you very much. John Sutton, who's the general manager of WESA, is in the back. He's waving. Everybody wave back. Good. And I especially want to thank our really good friends, Dee and John Hoyt. They're from our leadership circle, and it's their generous gift to us that helps to make tonight possible. So it's really terrific of them to help facilitate this. And if you join me in giving them a round of applause. Tonight is a celebration for a number of reasons. First, it's a chance for all of us to get together before winter really arrives in western Pennsylvania. And it's a chance to welcome Wade Goodwin to Pittsburgh. This is his first visit. So we made him wave a terrible towel. It was great. But it's also an important anniversary today. On this very date, 50 years ago, November 7th, 1967, Lyndon Johnson signed into law the Public Broadcasting Act. It was the legislation that made possible the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and ultimately created the infrastructure that would become America's public radio and public television stations. When he signed it into law, LBJ said that this announces that we want more than just material wealth in this country. We want more than just a chicken in every pot. We most of all want to enrich man's spirit. By creating CPB, Johnson set the stage for non-commercial media outlets all over the United States, creating content that commercial broadcasters either can't or won't produce. They showcase information, we showcase education, we showcase culture. We make it available universally, and we make it available free of charge to every American, regardless of their location or their ability to pay. Now, 50 years later, I would argue that there has never been a greater need for public broadcasting. I was reading yesterday that in the past 15 years, more than half of the jobs in journalism in the United States have disappeared. They're gone. In most places, this means sparser and shallower news coverage. Your newspaper still turns up, and those television newscasts are on every night, but their daily appearance belies the fact that their editorial staffs are a shell of what they used to be. And even great and successful newspapers like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal are scaling back their commitment to local news. In the case of the Journal, they're not doing local New York coverage for New Yorkers anymore. Now, there had been hope that the hyper-local and digital news sources would somehow fill the gap, but the news hasn't been good there either. In the past week, we lost the Houston Press, we lost the Baltimore City Paper, one of the major operators of local, hyper-local digital news services, shut down operations in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Washington, and San Francisco, ending an 8-year effort to figure out how you do news on the internet. And just last week, Spirited Media, which is a company that operates local news digital operations, including the Incline here in Pittsburgh, had its own round of layoffs. The bottom line is they just can't make their bottom line work. Good journalism is expensive, but good journalism is valuable. So when I say tonight's a chance to celebrate CPB and celebrate the Public Broadcasting Act, I'm also saying it's a chance to celebrate what may be one of our last shots at maintaining great journalism in the United States. NPR and its member stations around the country right now comprise the largest single journalistic effort in this country today. We are bigger than NBC, ABC, or CBS. We are bigger than CNN, Fox News, or even the Associated Press. We are, as local public broadcasting stations, independent entities, but we are joined by a common goal to strengthen our communities and our country by just telling the truth. The good news is that America is listening. Increasingly, the top source for news in communities around this country is no longer a commercial print or broadcast outlet. It's actually an NPR station. And that's only possible because of the generous support that so many of you show us and because of that Public Broadcasting Act that was 50 years ago today. So thank you, Lyndon Johnson, for prescience and commitment to public broadcasting, to the non-commercial and non-partisan approach to news that we take, all of which gives us confidence that quality journalism is alive and well 50 years later. Now, save that for our guest, because you're going to have a great time. We have a great program, and let's get it started. I'd like to introduce to the podium from 90.5 WESA Newsroom, Kevin Gavin.
Thank you, Terry. Good evening, everyone. Really hope you're enjoying this beautiful Heinz History Center. I think this is an appropriate setting for this evening's event. History, humankind's story, our story. Any reporter would love to be called a good storyteller because journalists are telling us stories. Stories that include scenes that take us to a location, facts, real facts. The stories also often include powerful voices, even if those voices are soft-spoken. When I listen to a report, a story from Wade Goodwin, I sit back. I listen to a story that's well told.
In many places, the flooding's receded, the water's gone, and Harvey's left one of the world's largest messes. Today is the first official Harvey Big Trash Day. The piles on the curb in Houston, they're like giant sculptures at their not so finest, you know, primitive with that soggy, stinky je ne sais quoi.
Oh, yeah.
I'm standing under one of the largest oak trees I've ever seen in my life. And as a middle-aged Texan, believe me, I've seen a lot of oak trees.
When this tree was a baby, King Carlos III of Spain owned this land. That's how old this tree is.
Perhaps nobody knows the great Trinity Forest better than Ben Sandifer. Accountant by day, he's a well-known local photographer and writer, and this 6,000-acre forest, it's his inspiration.
You're off my list then. I won't call you and remind you to vote.
Rushton trundles house to house in a warm October sun, ambushed by motion-activated zombies crawling out of front yard graves. Two doors down, Charlene Collins is worried about the election. When Rushton asks Collins what motivates her to vote the most...
Well, mainly it's the judges.
From New Braunfels and San Antonio down to Brownsville, back up the coast to Corpus Christi in Houston, and then across East Texas like a ladleful of gumbo, the accordion resisted all attempts to control it, and the infection, it seems, is now permanent. Diatonic button accordion had many qualities that made it attractive to a Texas working class agrarian community. First, they were cheap and easy to play.
He didn't know he was being used, my God.
The president told the gathering that the subject of grace had been on his mind since the shooting, that he'd been inspired by the grace of Pinckney and the ability of the family members of those who died to forgive the killer. And then Obama did something remarkable for a president.
Amazing grace.
Reverend Clemente Pinckney leaves behind a wife and two young daughters. Wade Goodwin, NPR News, Charleston.
You listen to that voice, soothing. Wade Goodwin's. Well, maybe President Obama's as well. But it's soothing even when the report is troubling. But Wade is versatile. He's proven that over the last 25 plus years. Whether he's telling you about the aftermath of the flooding of Hurricane Harvey, to an oak tree that's hundreds of years old. But then there's that word craft of his, sounding so natural when he speaks. The piles of trash, like giant sculptures at their not so finest, primitive with that soggy, stinky je ne sais quoi. That's Wade Goodwin. So Wade is based in Dallas. He started out as a freelancer with NPR in 1991, but before that, he was a political organizer. Early in his reporting career, he worked with John Burnett, who was already attached to NPR's Southwest desk. Wade has covered breaking news from Sunday's horrific shooting in Sutherland Springs to the killings of five police officers in Dallas last year, to the bombing of the federal office building in Oklahoma City, to natural disasters, hurricanes, tornadoes. But then there are the other daily issues that affect our lives that Wade also covers just as well, whether they're politics, agriculture, economics, or even the music industry. Well, this evening, Wade will be on the other side of the microphone. WESA reporter Margaret J. Krause will lead the conversation. Margaret is WESA's development and infrastructure reporter. Ladies and gentlemen, Margaret J. Krause, and NPR storyteller extraordinaire, Wade Goodwin.
These chairs are something. Sorry that you guys have those. Just kidding, they look comfortable too. There is no shortage of breaking news. Wade, you're coming to us from covering the Sutherland Springs shooting, the floods in Houston, and we're going to get to that. But in the interest of being as NPR as possible, we're going to start with some context. So Kevin noted you began reporting for NPR in 1991.
Right.
And you've been quoted as saying you weren't as interested in being a journalist as you were interested in being an NPR reporter. Help us understand that distinction.
Well, I guess I really didn't have an interest in journalism when I was a young man. It only came when I was in New York City for 7 years, and I spent a lot of time in my car, and I spent a lot of time listening to National Public Radio stuck in traffic. And somewhere along the line, it occurred to me, I mean, I was impressed listening, and I thought, you know, that would be a good job. And I used my organizing skills to organize my way into a lunch meeting with Robert Siegel, who after the lunch took me down to meet the head of the national desk. And they were like, well, you know, yeah, we'll see what you can do. And they didn't give me a job, but they agreed to work with me to try to teach me. I had never taken a journalism class in my life.
You're a history guy.
Yeah, I mean, I had no idea what I was doing. And in some ways, that turned out to be a benefit, because having not been given a template on how to do this job, I had to figure it out for myself. And since I didn't know what I was doing, I just tried to tell the story that I was trying to tell. And so I would, like, start at the beginning.
A very good place to start, one right. musical
and,
tells
and
us.
And it was simply out of complete and total ignorance that I developed a way of doing my stories that came from me trying to figure out the only thing I knew how to do, which was, like, well, just tell the story. And it seemed to me to, you know, I didn't start with the lead, I started with the background. So that it seemed everyone, you know, if I could just bring everybody along the way I got brought along as I did the story, as I researched the story, as I reported the story, then they would understand what I came to understand. And radio is a good medium for that. It is, people can sit and listen and for a long, long time, and we've seen it with books on tape, right? People will sit and listen for hours. And there was there's long been a feeling that shorter is better, but I think we're starting to see with podcasts. I think Ira Glass broke a lot of ground by saying, no, we can tell a story that's a full hour. So I think it was luck that I fell into the right place and was able to slowly figure out what the hell I was doing.
And so you've also talked about how there's this perception that the big work, the good work, is like the Ira Glass hour-long feature work, meaty stuff. But you said there's the opportunity in breaking news.
Yeah, I really do believe breaking news is where you find a lot of great stories. You just have to keep your eyes open to what is happening in front of you and keep your mind open so that you don't come into a story thinking you already know what that story is. It's one of the biggest mistakes reporters make. It can get worse as reporters get older. They can really start to think they know what the story is because they've done stories like this before, so they know. So they go into it looking for those elements that they've already got in their head is what the story they want to tell. I mean, I think the key for me as a reporter is to always try to keep some distance on what I think I think.
How do you do that? How do you keep these good people in mind, knowing that we don't know what the story is?
Keeping distance on what you think is one of the hardest things to do. It means keeping distance on yourself. It takes practice. It's not something young reporters can do. They're just trying to figure out what's going on in front of them. They're not trying to cope with their own sense of expectation and trying to keep a distance on that. If you practice it, it gets easier so that you're simply being in a place and immersing yourself in it, watching what is going on around you, not messing with your tape recorder, not messing with your phone, not trying to take notes, but watching, looking, seeing, thinking, listening. And then following your instincts about what you think you're seeing. And that's when you can surprise yourself. That's when you can start to get to the bottom of things because you're not filtering out. You're simply taking in. It's very kind of esoteric. It's hard for me to talk about these kinds of things with other reporters because it seems fairly nebulous what I'm saying. But I really do think it's a key to it's a key to good reporting. And it's a key to keeping yourself interested in the work by convincing yourself over and over again that you have not seen everything. In fact, you've barely scratched the surface. And if you keep your eyes and ears open and your head out of the way, you might learn something.
I think this is probably an appropriate time to say that you've covered a number of mass shootings and are coming from Sutherland Springs. How do you maintain that freshness in the wake of something that is becoming fairly commonplace?
It's hard, especially with a story like this that has begun to lack nuance. We have an angry male who has gotten an automatic weapon. He's used it to great effect and killed everybody and then has shot himself at the end. And, you know, it's tempting to say the end. We were talking about this today. It raises a political question, I think, and that is, the drumbeat of these mass shootings have picked up, I think. And we're getting to where we're getting a really bad mass shooting about every 6 weeks. And the question I have is this going to have a political effect by slowly, and I specifically wonder about conservative women, is this going to begin to have an effect on them and turn them against the Republican Party? Or, I think just as likely, we all become inured to the drumbeat of these mass shootings. I asked last night, I said, how many people are still thinking about Las Vegas? No one raised their hand. I mean, they'd moved on from Las Vegas. Well, Las Vegas was just 5 weeks ago. But, I mean, it's hard to, I mean, after Sandy Hook, which I think shocked the nation, it's getting harder and harder to stay shocked. I mean, after you've killed a bunch of innocent children, where do you go from there in the outrage department? So I don't know the answer to this question, but it's one that I'm going to keep looking at as we go forward, is that are these shooting? I mean, it's certainly, I think it's an embarrassment to the country. I mean, this is becoming our public face. It's becoming who we are. We're the country of mass shootings now. Well, that's not a good look. I don't care what your politics are. I just don't know whether or not there's going to be any political ramification. I mean, I know that there's a certain feeling of helplessness in the face of the NRA, but I just wonder if as the frequency continues, whether there is going to be a political effect of that, or simply we just become so numb that we give up. And I don't know the answer to that question.
And I've heard a few of you in the audience just now saying yes, yes. So I just want to say we're in this all together. I mean, we have the microphones currently, but there are two microphones in the crowd, and we're going to have an official Q&A period. But if you feel like you'd like to ask a question and jump in, please don't be shy.
Yeah, raise your hand if anybody wants to ask a question. We'll go back and forth, I think.
Yeah, we promise we'll keep asking each other questions, but all together. So how does that change? You said earlier today you have a go bag. So NPR calls and says, drop what you're doing. So how do you think about, what do you think about in that journey from where you are to where you're supposed to be?
There are different stories carry different import with them. Like when you have to go cover a hurricane, there are some particularly really awful dynamics after you've covered several. One is like, let's say I'm driving to the coast so that I get myself in position to where I'm going to get blasted by the thing, because that's where NPR wants me. So when you're driving to that spot, you're driving on a freeway that is completely free of cars, but the other side of the freeway is jammed with hundreds of thousands of cars who are desperately trying to get out. And that is unnerving.
Yeah, because they're all going, what is he doing?
Or you're kind of thinking to yourself, what do they know that I don't? And then you arrive in the city, and it's perfectly fine. Everything looks great. But you know that 24 hours from now, this place is going to look like a nuclear bomb hit it, because you've seen what hurricanes do to places. And so that's the opposite feeling. You know something that no one else knows, and that is this place that looks perfectly fine is going to be ruined in about 36 hours. And it's going to be, and it eats at you emotionally, in a way that's in kind of this primal way. I mean, so you go to the store and you buy lots of turkey and cheese and bread and water, and because that's what you're going to be living on for the next 3 days. You know, you learn all sorts of awful tricks, like when you get to your hotel room, you fill the bathtub up with water. Because after the electricity goes out, you're going to need to use your ice bucket to scoop the water out of the bathtub so you can flush the toilet. And there's all these awful little, kind of like I'm in the middle of Vietnam tricks, because once electricity goes out, the plumbing goes out, you can't get gas anymore, so you have to have gas cans strapped to, that's why you want to get a pickup truck. So you don't have to ride with the gas cans in the compartment. It can be in the back. And I mean, if I never cover another hurricane, I would be happy. I'll tell you that much. So these stories carry different kinds. School shootings are the worst, because towns who have undergone school shootings hate the media attention that comes with it. and blame the reporters for covering their suffering. And I mean, one of the worst was Jonesboro, where we had children who shot children. 13 and 11-year-old boy opened up fire and killed a bunch of teachers and girls from about 125 yards away with high-powered rifles. And, you know, that was an awful dynamic. And so there's lots of stories that I could do without going forward. And they're very difficult to cover because there's so much resentment. And also, I don't like prying into people's misery. You know, we don't do a whole lot of that at NPR, thank God. No one, I don't get requests to go interview the widow. And so I'm spared a lot of the more unpleasant aspects that a lot of reporters, editors feel compelled to make them go get the relatives of the people who were just murdered. We don't do that, you know. It's de-dignifying for those people who are recovering, and it's de-dignifying for us too. So, but it's still painful even when you're not doing the dirtiest of the dirty work.
What I hear you saying is you're a full-time human when you're reporting.
Well, I try to be. I mean, you know, it's the body count adds up, and even if you're doing the best you can in the midst of the carnage, after it's all over, you suffer in ways you don't always see. And so it's a trade-off. If you try to make yourself not feel so much because it gets in the way of your work, you pay for it on the back end. So it's really a balancing act between letting yourself feel something. Like at the end of the Oklahoma City bombing, I'd been there for a long time, 4 weeks or something, and I was the last reporter there, and it was the day they had kind of the memorial, and they had bagpipes playing Amazing Grace and trumpets, and I was trying to voice over this sound that I had in the piece, and when the trumpets were playing taps, and I'm trying to voice it, and I got about halfway through, and my throat just, it was the trumpets playing taps. I could not do it. And so I'm recording, they're listening to me in Washington, I'm not live, I'm recording, and I'm like, I stop and I think, just give myself a moment and I'll be okay. And I realize, ooh, I'm not gonna be able to talk again. And so I choke out, I'll call you back, okay. And so I wait about 15 minutes, I walk around, kind of get my composure, I call him back, and so I'm starting to describe the trumpets again, and it happens again. And I'm like, oh my God, I cannot, I may have to rewrite this paragraph, because it's choking, my own writing is choking me up. It was a little embarrassing, and I managed to finally get it out, and about 5 minutes later, there was a phone call, and it was the lead editor of NPR in Washington, and the technical staff in the recording room had called them up and said, told them what had happened, and he said, you need to go home. I was like, no, look, yeah, I'm okay. It was just this one scene, and they're like, no, you're done, you're out. And I did not realize, I really kind of believed what I was saying, that no, I am okay, but I really wasn't okay. And, you know, I needed an editor to come and say, you've done great work, but you need to go home. So it's a trade-off. There's no way to go to these things where it's so raw. I mean, like this church shooting in Sutherland Springs. I mean, these people who were murdered and their relatives, they had no idea who this guy was. You know, trying to kill his mother-in-law or something who wasn't even there. Sometimes she was, and now all their families are dead. You know, and they're mystified and devastated. and it's all so random. And how can you come to grips with this? It's impossible as a reporter, when you're hearing this kind of grief and reporting on it, not to be somewhat affected, although you try to be. Yes, you were. We have a
question. Hey. Sorry.
Yes.
Do we have
a microphone?
I do.
Yes,
sorry.
Stand up.
Oh, sorry. Good. Hello. So I have a question about frustration. So my family is actually from that area, and when I was driving home yesterday, I was so disheartened that I knew more about it than my mother, who lives right there, right? Because she actually is an educated woman, and she knows a lot, but she gets her information from Facebook, right? So.
Yep.
I mean, I realize that you're trying to tell a story from start to finish and educate people and inform people, but what do you do where, you know, family and friends aren't looking for this information, right? I mean, to me, the things that I knew, she's 20 minutes away from where this happened, and she had such a poor level of understanding of what's actually happening with the shooting and information, stuff like that. So my question is, one, how do you expand this information so that everybody can understand it? And two, does it frustrate you because you're doing the best that you can and the people that actually need to hear it?
Well, I do think the internet has done the country and perhaps the world a disservice in that, you know, when I was a boy growing up, we got our news from the local newspaper and from the evening news. We watched Walter Cronkite. And the advantage of that was we were all kind of getting our news from the same source, and it helped us all have a certain perspective on what the day's events were. That's gone away. Now we choose our news sources, and we choose the ones that give us the news that conforms to our political perspective. And, you know, I think we've gotten pretty good at dismissing, you know, news that is not coming from those sources as fake news. I mean, I certainly, you know, get a large dose of fake news at me from, you know, my friends and relatives that I grew up with in North Carolina and Texas. And ironically, fake news was a term that was used to describe truly fake news that was being promulgated on the internet, and then it got turned to describe real news that was politically unpalatable. So fake news is often the words used to describe real news that you don't want to hear about because it's not conforming to your ideology. I don't know the answer to this question. It is frustrating. I don't know it's within our power as reporters to do anything about that. I mean, we can only report what we report. I mean, and I guess there's one other, I mean, there's been, since Donald Trump has been elected, there's been a strong push from many listeners that it is up to NPR to do something about this, to oppose it, to do reporting that is in opposition, that is a strong voice to say this is not right. And I think we've gotten very clear among ourselves that that is not our mission. Our mission is to do what we do, and that is go out, report the story, and do investigative work and dig into what we do, and do it just as well or better than we always have. I don't think it is our place to try to stand in opposition to what many of our listeners feel is the wrong direction for the country. And so Matt, maybe answer your question is that I don't think it's my mission, my job, to take that on. In fact, you know, it would pervert what I was trying to do. It would, you know, what I'm trying to do is get some distance on what I think, not trying to convince everybody else what I think.
And I don't, in some ways, we're still in the early days of the fracturing of the media landscape. I mean, well, I guess it doesn't feel like it if you're a newspaper.
Depends on if you've been fired from your newspaper job or not.
Multiple times, right. And sir, I see your hand. I just want to say, Kevin talked about stories in the introduction to this evening, and I wonder what you think in terms of, there's a certain clarion call to stories. Over time, maybe there will be kind of a return to, I don't think stories lose their importance, and maybe heightens their importance. I don't know.
No, I mean, our job hasn't changed. I don't think the politics of the current situation has changed what we do. We just got to keep doing what we do and do it as diligently as we always have. And I think at NPR, we're pretty clear about that. And that's not a very satisfying answer for a lot of our listeners. So, you know, we've taken, people on the right, people will say liberal NPR. And on the left, the people will scoff and say corporate NPR. You know, they used to be good, but now they've lost their soul. And you just have to resist these characterizations from both sides and keep your eyes on the journalistic prize, and that is getting the story.
And sir, you had a question in the back.
Mr. Goodman, I have been a big fan of your reporting for many years. You'll forgive a little bit of dwelling on the terrible events in Texas over the weekend, but I was struck when I heard your reporting Monday morning about how thoughtful and detailed it was without the wallowing in the gore, without the invective and vitriol that I hear in so much other coverage on so many other stations. In the past year, I know groups like the Poynter Center for Media Ethics and other sort of experts in the field have come out with some very specific guidelines about reporting on those types of mass violent events. Is that something that you and your production team think about or reflect on, about how do you cover this without doing it inappropriately? Or is it something that comes naturally?
That's a very good question. I mean, unfortunately, I have covered so much violence and carnage, I almost feel like I'm a war correspondent. I mean, from the massacre at Luby's to the standoff at Waco to the Oklahoma City bombing to Pearl, Paducah, Jonesboro, Columbine, Fort Hood. I mean, I could bore you all night with the list of, you know, blood and it has taught me that the way to cover these things is that you dial down the writing. You make it softer. You make it blander. You simply focus on the facts. And the facts are so awful that if you simply tell them straightforwardly, without any hyperbole, without any hype, without any drama, you don't need the drama, it's all so horrible that if you just quietly report, that's the way to do it. And that's the way to be respectful to the subject you're talking about, is not to capitalize on the awfulness. I mean, and that's where I mean, not to be too critical of my brothers in the TV news reporting world, but there is so much sotto voce, you know, oh, it's so horrible here. It's disrespectful. Stop capitalizing on other people's misery to try to make yourself seem more important. Or you try to make the moment seem more important. That is not what you're there for. You're there to tell people the awful facts, and the awful facts speak for themselves. They certainly don't need any aggrandizing. So, and it took me a while to figure it out, but once you figure that out, once you realize that the key here is to be quiet and to be respectful, that is part of what I think people can react to, because they don't want to be de-dignified or disrespected by having you try to hype some situation to make them feel some way that the reporter thinks they should feel, that they're not even really feeling themselves, I don't think. They're all about acting a certain way in front of the camera. And radio helps you have that distance, because I'm not on the camera. All I have to do is write it and speak it, and so that's how I try to do it, which is the more horrible it is, the quieter I try to become in my writing.
And so You've talked about also being a storyteller. I know Kevin did too. But storytelling, where does storytelling meet reporting? How do you balance those two?
Well, for me, I mean, it's all part of the same thing. I hate to go back to what I said before, but it's really rooted in my own inability to do the profession professionally. Since I don't know what I'm doing, I just try to tell the story of what I've learned, and that's it.
And but you come from the Southern tradition of storytelling.
I do. I mean, I grew up around the dinner table with my mom and dad telling stories, especially my father. And I grew up in a culture where storytelling is really prized and valued, and sitting around on a porch with a drink in your hand or a beer and telling stories is a way to spend an evening. And those who do it best are valued as prized human beings to be around. So I think that's part of it too, but it also comes from the fact that I don't know how to do it differently than that.
And so you have a distinctive style, which is something that tends to make editors nervous. Did you just say like, no, really, I want to keep the sentence in?
Especially in the early years, it was a problem because I had no credibility. And so editors would like, you can't do it this way. The problem was I didn't know how to do it any other way, so it really wasn't a conversation that was up for debate, since this was the only way I could do it. And eventually over time, it took a long time. I would say it took between 5 and 10 years for what I do to be kind of accepted. And it was grudging. And it can still be grudging, believe it or not. So it's kind of a constant battle to, and this is the other thing I try to tell young reporters is, so many of the young reporters want to sound like Ira Glass now. And, there's a way to do that. You have these long pauses. You breathe and deliver a certain way. You talk through your nose. But they're doing themselves a disservice. As wonderful as Ira is, and he is, and the reason they're drawn to Ira is because he's so unique. He's so himself that he's compelling. And they think, I want to be that compelling. Well, you got to be compelling your own way. You can't be Ira Glass. You're not going to be better than Ira Glass at being Ira Glass. So you've got to find your own voice, and that takes time. You have to grow into yourself. So you have to be patient, because you're not going to sound any different at first. You have to figure out who you are, how you write, and then be true to that. And that takes time. That takes a decade of doing this work, to figure out how you think you're supposed to sound and how, when you write, you're writing for your own voice. And so I say that a lot to young reporters who look at me like, thanks for nothing, I'll see you in 10 years, great.
Well, not to belabor the point, but is there a story that is present Wade Goodwin you wish you could go back that you did as early reporter? And redo?
Say it again. I didn't quite understand the question.
So knowing what you know now, you have to write for yourself. You have to be your own best version of yourself, not hide your light under a bushel. Is there a story you wish you could go back?
If you listen to me, in my early part of my career, I rushed through my stories because I had more that I wanted to say, but I didn't have time to say it. So I was saying things really fast so I could try to get it all in. And it took me a long time to figure out, you're just going to have to bite the bullet, dude, and just say what the time's going to allow you to say and slow down. And so that slowing down changed kind of everything. My voice got deeper.
By slowing down?
By slowing down, right. Because when you talk faster, your voice goes up. And simply by accepting the fact that I was only going to be able to say a certain amount and rushing was not going to help anybody, including myself, it was after that that people would say, man, you got a great voice. But no one said I had a great voice during the first 10 years of my career, not because my voice was different, just because my delivery was so different. And that's part of learning how to write for yourself, too. This is all a very specific skill set that it's really a very complicated and difficult craft. The other thing that you have to teach yourself as a reporter is how to listen to people. And that's hard for young reporters, too, because they're very worried about how they're coming across. So they're thinking, how am I being received? You know, are they respecting me? Am I respecting myself? I mean, there's a dialogue going on in young reporters' heads that has nothing to do with what the person is saying to them. You have to shut that dialogue off so that you can hear what is being said to you and then ask questions based on what they just said to you. I mean, I never carry a list of questions into any interview.
I don't normally, I swear.
Because it gets in the way of your listening. You want to ask questions based on what the person just said. I mean, you'll say, wait a minute. So tell me more about that. Tell me more about that. And that's a question I use a lot. And it's a question that opens people up like flowers. Because when you say, tell me more about what you mean, it communicates to them that I'm listening to you carefully, and I'm very interested in what you say, and please tell me more about what you think about this. And, you know, I have found that you get, you know, a lot more flies with honey than you do with vinegar. I am never confrontational in my interviews. I will say, well, look, let me run something by you. Here's what people will say about this. And then I will give the argument that contradicts what they're saying, but I don't put it in my voice. I say, what do you say to this argument that people say? So that they don't feel like I'm trying to argue with them. I simply say, this is an argument someone else has. And I think it's important for people to feel like the reporter is trying to be on their side. And I do try to be on their side. And I also try to put them in the story saying what they want to say. That's how you be respectful. It's also how you do right by their political point of view. So you don't try to trick them into saying something that's going to embarrass them. You put the best of their argument in the story and let someone else answer that. I mean, sometimes their best argument is so bad that they hear it and they think, that was great. And other people are going to think, God, what a moron that guy was. But the important thing is that when they hear themselves, they think that was great. And that's that took me time, too, to understand that the way to do this is to put people in the piece the way they want to be in the piece.
Well, what do you think that does for us as a news organization?
I'd say it again. I didn't quite.
What do you think that does for us as a news organization? When people listen and hear themselves or maybe someone they can identify at their best?
Well, one of my really good editors who spent years as a newspaper reporter would say that after he did a big investigative piece, he would call the people up that, you know, had just gotten skewered and ask them if they felt like he'd been fair. Now, that was a bridge I could not get to in my own journalistic life, but I always admired him for doing it. And I think it built a ton of trust for him as a newspaper reporter in Baltimore. I do not call up people and say, hey, did you hear the story? Do you think you're okay with it? But I do try to put them in a way that I think they'll like, that I think they'll think was fair. And that does help. I have lots of conservative sources who will say to me that they think I get it. And I don't know that I get it, but what I am doing is putting them in my stories the way they want to be in the story.